Life was filled with guns and war, and everyone got trampled on the floor. I wish we'd all been ready. Children died, the days grew cold. A piece of bread could buy a bag of gold. I wish we'd all.
Ah, yes, Larry Norman's I Wish We'd All Been Ready. If you grew up during the time that I did, when you heard that song kick on, you probably got chills. If you don't know the song, then count yourself lucky, because maybe that means you weren't raised in a home where a church where the threat of hell hung over you and the concept of the rapture and all these things were a part of your life. Today's episode is kind of a special one for me. I have been talking lately online, interacting with people about the way that evangelicals often present the gospel, you know, the good news. And recently there were several posts, things like, you have two choices, you know, accept Jesus or go to hell kind of stuff. And I'm not exaggerating, by the way. And that has garnered a lot of conversation. It's really kind of stimulated some people to start talking. And I started going on about some other things that were related to the treatment of children and how I believe that when you're telling a 4 or 5-year-old child how that if they don't love Jesus, they're going to burn in hell forever or whatever, that this is a traumatic thing to put on a kid. That opened up a whole conversation where I have had multiple people not only reach out to me or not only comment on Twitter or whatever, but that have reached out to me privately to want to share their stories and talk about some of the things they've been through. Because there's a group of people that wanted to argue that this is not the case, that nobody tells children this. And then lots of people came out saying, hey, well, hold on. I personally experienced this. And so I'm going to talk a little bit today about evangelical trauma and growing up in the evangelical church. And I'm going to use my experience because, as always, I like to share my observations and have them be fact-based because they're things that I experienced myself. And I hope that you get something from this. Let me first start before I even go any further and just spend about a minute or two on my parents. My dad was pastor of our church. He was one of the old school hellfire and brimstone type pastors. My mom was a nurse, and she was also our piano player and taught the ladies. We were a very traditional family, very traditional church, very conservative. And my parents were awesome. My dad was, and continues to be, he's 94 now, one of the most loving, caring people I've ever known. And I think I've mentioned him on the podcast before, but he was exactly what you would want in a pastor. And that is that he loved the people. He would do anything for them. He spent hours either in hospitals or at people's houses or at the church praying and talking to people and loving them. And he did things, you know, when you grow up in the country, small towns, it's fun because you get to see things that are more real than what you see, for example, on some preacher that's got a YouTube channel or a mega church or whatever, because it's real people every day face to face. For example, when we had some folks that when they were out of town, my dad would go over, if they were like gone for a week, he'd go over there and milk their cow every day. That's awesome. You just don't see that anywhere. And he was a part-time taxi. He was a part-time ambulance. I mean, he was always serving the people. Mom, wonderful woman. She had a bit of a sarcasm to her. She was a lot of fun to interact with. And I've always had a great relationship. My mom died last year, but had a great relationship with both of them. Still do with my dad. And I think the world of them. Some of the things they taught and believed purely from the heart were traumatic and terrible. And I don't believe that anything that they did was intentionally abuse or anything of that level. So I want to be real clear. When I talk about telling a child this, I consider it abuse. I think abuse also has to be purposeful. I think the person has to intend to do harm. Sometimes people just work with the best they have. And I think my parents, in all sincerity, were worried that any of their children may die and go to hell. And so they taught them in a way that had these theological foundations that I completely disagree with, but does not reflect on them as people. And anybody listening to this, if this is a theology or a theological position you hold, I take great issue with it, but not with you. I think that you're doing your best, just like all of us, to try to understand something bigger than we are. And whether that's reading scripture and trying to understand the Bible and how it works, or being a humanist and studying people and trying to be the best you can, whether you're a Christian or an atheist or Buddhist, I don't really care. I think all of us are just trying our best to sort things out and do what's right. And that doesn't mean everybody's necessarily a nice person or whatever. But my point being, some of the criticisms that I'm going to lay on evangelicalism today, I don't want to come across as, oh, I think my parents were abusive, or, oh, I think people that teach this now are horrible people. I think that they are, they don't understand what they're doing. They don't understand what harm they could be causing, but I don't think in many cases it's purposeful. And so if any of those happen to listen today, maybe you'll rethink your approach. I don't know. But one of the things that, and just to set the stage, I was born in 1965. So I was basically grew up in the 70s and the 80s. And that was also during the height of the satanic panic. And so we're going to cover that a little bit as well. But first, let me talk about fear. Fear is psychologically very, very powerful. If you even watch today on how people vote, if you were in the middle of an election year, I received so many flyers and emails and everything, and every single one of them, I don't care if they came from a Republican or from a Democrat or from an independent, almost every single one of them have almost the exact same message. This is the end. If my opponent wins, all of democracy is going to fall apart. Or if my opponent wins, God's going to rain down hellfire on us. Or if my opponent wins, it's going to be the end of the life as we know it. And it, because fear drives people. It drives people to the polls. It drives people to act. And so fear is a psychological thing that people often use to try to push people into doing what they want. Bullies operate on fear. You know, they trust that when they start their bullying behavior that you're going to be afraid, and therefore you're going to do whatever it is they're demanding. So one of the things that happens when we are faced with fear is we have what's called a fight or flight response. It's an evolutionary thing. It was made, in fact, if any of you have cats, just pay attention to them. You'll learn all about fight or flight. Because if you startle a cat, they either raise up and hiss and have a defensive posture where they make themselves look large, or they bolt into the other room and gone. That is something that is in all of us. And it's something that over the course of centuries, eons, whatever you want to say, has allowed animals to be able to survive in the wild. It's probably one of the best survival skills that you can have, because what happens is when you have that fight or flight response, when you have a fear perception, you don't always have time to act. You don't always have time to process and think through what you're going to do. You need to act. So, for example, picture yourself walking through the forest and a bear comes out at you. Now, I know what they tell us to do. Don't run. But quite frankly, if a bear came out, I think I would go in immediately and to get the hell out and run. I probably would end up dead. That's why I don't hang out with bears. but the point being, fight or flight allows us to make very, very rapid movements and decisions without really having to tap into our rational mind and process through what's going on. Okay, moving forward from that, there's some psychological perspectives on fear as well. Phobias, for example, anxiety disorders, those things grow out of fears, whether they're rational or irrational. You can start developing some serious phobias and anxiety disorders that are fear-based. Spiders, for example, for me, if you put a spider on me, I'm going to be jumping around, freaking out. I've tried to become a better person and not kill spiders anymore, but oh man, if one gets on me, I'm in a panic. That could be a completely harmless spider. And that would be for me a very irrational fear, but you know what? It's there. I don't like them. I'm going to react. Anxiety disorders, on the other hand, are a little bit farther reaching. If you have somebody in a constant state of fear, if you have someone where you're constantly putting in front of them things that's going to create the anxiety and fear, then they can develop a full-blown anxiety disorder. And our early life experiences shape a lot of our fears and anxieties. In fact, to this day, I mean, you've heard me talk on this podcast about tarot readings and oracle cards and probably other stuff, Reiki and everything. I don't have an Ouija board in my house. I'm scared of them. Is it irrational? Probably. But because The Exorcist in 1973 featured an Ouija board at the beginning, that became a cultural phenomenon where people associated Ouija boards or spirit boards with demonic possession. And what happened is it made us afraid of them. It made a lot of people afraid of them. So instead of this fun game that you can buy at Target or Walmart, it suddenly became this portal for demons to come into your house. Now, again, I don't believe that, but I'm not going to have one in my house because I have this irrational, you know, it's whatever it is. And again, I think it grew out of The Exorcist is where it got, really broadcasted a lot for people to think that there was something demonic about them. It's a cultural thing. And it's a Scott thing. What's my point? My point is, there are things that can be placed into your head when you're young that you take in and you believe because it's what you're hearing it from people you trust. In the case of evangelicalism, you're hearing that God said this, that this is, you know, what Jesus said, this is what you need to believe, this is what whatever. And what can happen is children can really internalize a lot of that. And when they do, it's very, very harmful. Now I'm going to switch a little and talk about how that plays out in real life. Again, the 70s and 80s, the satanic panic was a widespread social phenomenon in the United States. I think it was in other parts of the world as well, but the United States was really kind of a big place where you saw a lot of it. And it exploded. There was this idea that there were these secret satanic cults that were out there and they were doing all these terrible things from child sacrifice to ritual abuse to whatever. And as this continued to grow, the media played right into it. And in fact, I recently was watching some true crime shows. One of them is about the West Memphis Three. And most likely, the wrongful finding of guilt on these guys kind of went back to, one of them was kind of a goth kid. It's a small town, but it was during this satanic panic period. And people assumed that he was a Satanist because he listened to heavy metal music, because he dressed in black. And putting all that together, one of the people that was charged was found guilty because he looked different, because he creeped people out, because he looked like what they thought a Satanist would look like. I think the religious fundamentalism, the conservative Christianity that was really growing and exploding during the 70s and 80s played a huge role in this. And in fact, there was in the back of the church where I was at, there were these little comic books that were Jack Chick. They still exist. He's not around anymore. So he can't do any more harm to people other than he left a lot behind. But if you go to chick.com, and by the way, this is not an advertisement for them. I don't suggest you give them any money, but you can see these cartoon tracks. And they're really, really creepy stuff. And keep in mind, you know, children reading this, cartoons are interesting anyway, and they're really cool looking. There was a particular one that stuck out to me because I had the only panic attack I've ever had in my entire life around this one. And it was called This Is Your Life. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This Was Your Life. And in fact, I've even the other day when I posted about Jack Chick Tracks on Twitter, somebody commented and said, This Was Your Life. I still remember that one. The basic premise of the track is what the final judgment's going to be. And so you have this guy, he's smoking and drinking and he dies. And, you know, then suddenly he goes to his judgment. And it's kind of interesting, even as you read through it, you've got the preacher kind of standing over the grave saying he was a good man, but then it's got little verses below that says we're all as an unclean thing and all our righteousness is as filthy rags. And so it's really building in this piece of the evil of man, and how we're depraved and we're bad. And so as the cartoon goes along, the guy goes up and there's all the dead, small and great, standing before God, and they start reviewing his life. And the way it's presented in this comic book, which is what I thought was reality, was this big movie screen, and everybody's standing there watching. And it starts even as a baby. It's got a baby on the screen, and the guy says to this angel that's with him, look, that's me as a baby. Does that mean everything I've ever done is going to be reviewed? And then there's the creepy, out-of-context Bible verse, for there is nothing hid which shall not be made manifested. And so then it shows him later, there you are as a teenager, and he's telling a dirty joke. And he's going, no, stop, not that story, not here. And then it shows him later checking out a woman. And everything in here, it's laid down with these creepy Bible verses. And he's saying, why didn't anybody warn me about this? And then they show him in church and how he wasn't paying attention and everything. Well, what ends up happening, of course, is this guy, God sends him to hell. And it's got all the scary hell stuff. It's got burning lake of fire. It's got, you know, whoever was found not written in the book of life will be cast into the lake of fire. And so it really lays out this scary, scary scenario. Now, the last couple of pages squeezes in, it doesn't have to be this way, and it shows an alternate version where he prays and asks for forgiveness and salvation, and he gets to go to heaven. But I do want to point out, this is a 23-page track. 18 pages are all the bad stuff. 18 out of 23. It's not till you get to page 19 that you get the little twist. Now, why is that? If I were going to present someone with the gospel, if I wanted to tell them about the love of Jesus and how God wants them to love him and he loves them and be a part of them, why would I spend 18 out of 23 pages scaring the shit out of people? Well, I'll tell you why. Because it's fear-based. This track was in every single one of them are this way. They're specifically set up to create anxiety and fear in the person reading it so that they're scared. Because then what happens is you're like, holy shit, I don't want that to happen to me. What am I going to do? This was a big thing, okay? And it still is. In fact, I'm learning just how bad and prevalent it still is because I'm reminded of it as I'm interacting with people on social media and having these very discussions. Along with this, Jack Chick, who, you know, again, this is good media. This is stuff that really gets in there. Along with him, there were some people that came forward that talked about how they were in satanic cults, and they were victims of ritual abuse. And there was a lot of really bad psychology that was occurring during that time. Some mental health professionals were trying to do recovered memory therapy, which I am a believer in, but they were doing it in a very sloppy way. And by the way, all of this has been discredited since, okay? But what they were doing is having these people that were claiming that they had gone through been part of these widespread satanic cult activities. And it sounded kind of credible when you had like a psychologist saying, oh yes, I've had this many patients that have had this happen. This continued to grow. And one of the most high profile public figures during my time was Mike Warnke. Now this guy was good. Okay. He wrote a book called The Satan Seller. And the basic story of Mike Warnke is that he was, had entered into a satanic cult, and that he eventually raised up to a very high position. He was like a high priest within these satanic cults. And he described the rituals and the other things they did. And it absolutely confirmed everything everybody believed. Now, keep in mind, nobody ever really busted in and caught any of these cult members doing these things. Nobody ever saw Satanists sacrificing babies or doing things, but they always heard the rumbling. They always heard the rumors, and it was always scary. In almost any town you went to, there was some story about some place that they would meet. In fact, when I went to college, there was a real popular place out in the middle of nowhere that was that people said, that's where the Satanists meet. And almost anywhere you went, you'd hear that, but nobody really knew who they were. But Mike Warnke came along, and he had found Jesus and had become a Christian. And he was a very good storyteller, a fantastic storyteller. I saw him in concert more than once. He was also a comedian. He stole a lot of his stuff, I think, from Gallagher. In retrospect, I've learned. But at the time, I thought he was so funny, and he was just so sincere. There was a problem, though. Mike Warnke was lying the whole time. He was making everything up. There was a magazine called Cornerstone Magazine that did a expose on him, where they started getting information that people were saying, hey, wait a minute. I went to high school with him. That's not who he was. And other stories, pretty much everything he said didn't check out. But, you know, here, this is where I need to sidetrack. We are so eager to believe anything that confirms our biases, that somebody like Mike Warnke went for years with books and concerts. He was making bank, tons of money, and nobody bothered to question it. Nobody said, you know, do we need to look into his background a little bit and make sure this guy's legit? He spoke at schools. He spoke at churches. He spoke in arenas. I mean, it's just amazing to me. And in fact, I want to do a plug for another podcast, Last Podcast on the Left. They do a whole series on the Satanic Panic and Mike Warnke, and it's just phenomenal. But yeah, this guy was a fraud. But what he did is he kept people believing the things that they feared. In addition to that, Dungeons and Dragons and other role-playing games were accused of promoting Satanism. And they even had a couple of movies came out that tried to build on this. You know, how these Dungeons and Dragons players, I can't remember the name, there was one, Monsters and Mazes or something. And the story was, this guy lost contact with reality and all this kind of stuff. I played Dungeons and Dragons for a lot of years. I don't know why that particular game my parents were cool with, except my mom was asked one time about it, and she said, I'd rather have my kids sitting at the kitchen table with his friends playing games than out drinking or doing other things with, you know, partying, or where I don't know where he is. And so I think that, and I think the fact she witnessed it firsthand and could tell that this was not a satanic thing, but I guarantee you all the time, I even remember when I was in 9th or 10th grade, getting confronted by one of my school teachers about Dungeons and Dragons and saying, you know, it's satanic and drugs and all this kind of stuff. And it just all this fueled this idea that there's this underlying culture of Satanism where they are indoctrinating children, and they're trying to, you know, Dungeons and Dragons was a gateway into this evil, and as were Ouija boards and everything else. And so what ended up happening is that, well, a lot of bad things. If you go read about the McMartin preschool trial, or if you read about the West Memphis Three, those are just two examples of how this got so out of hand that people were accused of heinous things that were not even based in reality. But people believed it because they wanted to, because fear was in them. They had this fear, and we'd rather be able to explain something. And so it must be the occult, or it must be, you know, Satan, or it must be whatever. During this period, evangelical media really played a role in perpetuating this. This surge in evangelical Christianity was happening. And they were starting to do things like make movies. For example, in 1974, a film came out called The Burning Hell. That movie scared the shit out of me. Now, I was probably 9 or 10 years old. Knowing it came out in 74, my dad showed it at our church. I love him. I want to say that again. I think my dad was doing everything he could to save souls, and I think he meant it with all his heart. But this movie was evangelical horror. The premise of the movie was that this guy, and I can't remember all the details, it's been a while, and somebody recently said it was on YouTube. It's a terrible film, but if you want to go watch it, this guy, I think his friend is killed like in a motorcycle accident. I do remember he was beheaded, and that was something for me to see as a kid. Now, I'm sure if you go look at this movie now compared to what we have now, in terms of the quality and special effects and everything, it probably, you're going to say this looks silly, but picture you're in an evangelical church in a small town where you're protected from nearly everything. I mean, we couldn't watch any television in which there were any bad words or anything. Obviously, nothing that had any kind of sexual content, and horror would be completely out of the question. And then you sit a kid down that's that sheltered, and you put a movie on where it starts with a beheading, and then from there, this guy goes, I think, to the funeral, and the preacher's talking about, you know, what happens to people when they die and all this, and it shows all these graphic, vivid portrayals of hell, and it was gross, it was creepy. We had people at our church running out of the sanctuary crying. At the end, we had tons of people coming down the aisles, including people that had been Christians for years that weren't just quite sure, and this scared them so bad they wanted to just make sure they're saved. And I mean, this kind of stuff is fucked up. I don't know how else to say it. You don't do this to people. Scaring people into conversion or scaring people into reaffirming their faith, that's extortion. On top of that, there were some other movies. One came out in 1972. It was called, or 1973. It was called A Thief in the Night. It was one of three or four movies. I think the second one was called A Distant Thunder. I don't remember the third one, maybe Image of the Beast or Mark of the Beast or something. But A Thief in the Night was about the rapture. Now, those of you, oh, by the way, the song I opened with was in A Thief in the Night. It played in it. The whole concept of the rapture, which I could spend a lot of time talking about it, but I want to give you the brief history. Nobody really, you know, what we know now, what evangelicals teach now, a lot of them is this idea that there's going to be, that Jesus is going to come back. He's going to take all the Christians out. They're going to just disappear, go up into the air. Then there's going to be this 7-year period of tribulation where all these terrible things happen. And if you have to take the mark of the beast, you probably heard about that, 666. If you don't take the mark of the beast on your right hand or forehead, then you won't be able to buy food or anything. And it's this whole post-apocalyptic disaster nightmare. I know the Left Behind series came out not that long ago, just in the last decade or 15 years or so. I didn't watch any of them. I didn't read any of the books, but they're the same concept. Thief in the Night was just ahead of them. This idea of the rapture and the tribulation and all that didn't even come around in Christianity till like the late 1800s, I believe. And only because there was a Bible called the Scofield Reference Bible, which was a great study Bible because it had all these little notes, but the notes were so detailed and drew from this theory of how the end times are going to go, and they made it all make sense. Oh, this is what Revelation means, and this is how it you know, is a fulfilling of the prophecy in Daniel and all that. This Bible was so good at tying all that together that as you're reading it, you almost forget you're reading notes because it feels like you're getting more of this word from God. And so what happened was it took off and became extremely popular among the Baptists and among, there's a lot of groups. I know that the Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, Lutherans, a lot of them reject this. And there's other views of the millennial reign and all this kind of stuff. But this premillennial rapture and tribulation period really caught hold with a lot of churches. And what happened was movies like A Thief in the Night displayed it. And so you have this woman who wakes up and the radio announcer suggesting that, you know, all the, or not suggesting, but is saying that millions of people have disappeared. He suggests it might be the rapture of the church, and her husband's disappeared, and all these bad things happen. You know, the United Nations sets up this government system, and then everybody has to receive the mark of the beast. Did you catch that? The United Nations were the bad guys. Man, sometimes I feel like we're right back where we were in terms of how people view things and mix their politics and their religion. But putting that aside, there's flashbacks in it where she, you know, had opportunities to be saved and she didn't, and all these things. And so, at the end, she's refusing to take the mark because she kind of knew she wasn't supposed to do it, and she's trying to avoid them and everything. She ends up being chased and cornered on a bridge and falls off to her death. Then they have the little surprise at the end where she awakes and realizes it's all been a bad dream. But then what happens in great horror, you know, closing out, the radio comes on announcing all these people have disappeared, and she's frantically searching for her husband, and he's missing too. So then she realizes the rapture actually occurred and she's been left behind. Scary stuff. Picture 8-year-old Scott watching that. That stuff scared me to death. Oh, I mentioned, I'm jumping around. You'll have to live with that. I mentioned the only panic attack I've ever had. I remember very specifically, and I don't know how old I was, but I'm guessing between about 8 and 10, maybe 7. Crying and panicked in the middle of the night because of that fucking Jack Chick track, because I was so afraid and embarrassed that everybody was going to see my whole life. And I'd already become a Christian. I'd already prayed the sinner's prayer. I'd gone down, done all that. I'd been baptized. I didn't have any reason to fear all this, except this stuff just digs into you and you have this anxiety all the time. Because, you know, what happens is you're told, you know, when you get saved, the Holy Spirit enters you and then you're a new person. Well, when you do some of those old things and you don't change dramatically, or maybe you change for a while and then, you know, come back and fall into some of your old habits, you start thinking maybe that salvation didn't take the first time. Maybe I didn't pray it right. Maybe I didn't have enough faith. And so you're begging God again to save you. You're trying, it's this circular fear of hell and the tribulation period and all these things that cause people to like live in this constant state of they've got to do something to make sure they're not going to go to hell. A Thief in the Night was very, very powerful. So was The Burning Hell. The same people that came streaming down the aisles during one of the movies, we're doing that again during the next one. These movies were, especially The Burning Hell, was distributed to churches. It was specifically to scare the shit out of people so they would become Christians. Now, I don't have any problem with somebody becoming a Christian. I was a Christian, have been most of my life. I'm not now, but up until age, I don't know, 54 or something. I have a problem with somebody becoming a Christian because they're scared of going to hell. That's not really what Christianity should be thinking about. It's really about trying to have a relationship with God or your higher power or whoever, you know, in the Christian world, it's God who created you and loves you and sent his son to die for you and all these things. And even though that all is a lot to lay on a kid, you know, when you tell a 6-year-old Jesus had to die on the cross because of your sins, kid. And it's 6-year, you know, what's a 6-year-old doing? They're thinking, oh, what did I do? I thought bad, you know, I was irritated with my mom. You know, I remember I used to try to think up sins to pray and ask for forgiveness for, because I couldn't think of anything I'd done wrong. I was kind of a boring kid. But this whole depiction of that creates this fear, puts you in this circular life of, you know, drawing closer to God, then pulling away, then drawing closer, then pulling away, always in fear. music videos. Carmen, I remember specifically, and I loved Carmen when I was in college, but he had a video called Witch's Invitation that tells the story of a Christian encounter with witchcraft and how prayer had to overcome it. I don't know if any of you know about the Hell Houses. You can Google this, but it's a big thing that evangelicals started doing around Halloween, where they would create a Hell House. And what it basically is it's like any house of horrors or whatever you want to call them that, you know, people go to get scared, except these are all including scenes that have satanic cults, drug use, other things that are sinful behaviors. And we even had one at our church. So I think my dad may have been the founder of Hell Houses, although, you know, we just did it a couple of years and I think that was all. But they're designed to scare the shit out of you. Now, I can tell you that one of the most popular Hell Houses, and I think it's credited with being the first one, was in Colorado. A guy I went to college with was the one that started it. I didn't even know that. I was seeing a special on it. There was some kind of documentary, and they were interviewing people, and there he was. And I was like, oh my God, I know him. And he was a good guy. But he bought into this fear-based spirituality. I mean, who really, just think about in general, wanting to be spiritually engaged. Is fear where you want to start? Because that's not healthy. That's not good for you. Now, this obsession with the end times, eschatological obsession with apocalyptic prophecies and all this, it takes a toll on people. It's a psychological toll. When you are so focused on what's going to happen and the bad things, I'm seeing even today people are, you know, it's every day. There's somebody that's saying, oh, this is a sign of the end times. Oh, things are going to go bad. Oh, it's going to get worse. My mom used to say this a lot, and God bless her. She's such a wonderful person. But she would say, oh, I can tell, you know, the Bible says this. And so every time a war broke out, this is a sign of the end times. Every time anything, you know, we would have bad weather. And I don't mean like just bad weather, but like a big a hurricane would hit somewhere. This is a sign of the end times. And that fear is right back in there. You know, am I going to go through the tribulation period? Am I going to be able to skip out? What's going to happen to my friends? This constant catastrophic end time stuff. And there's some gruesome shit to read. When you read in the Bible and it talks about, you know, blood flowing up on horses, like up to their saddles or whatever. I can't remember exactly how it's worded. I probably could have done a little bit of prep here, but this idea that you know, there's going to be this mass bloodshed and you know, when God comes back to reign, it's going to kill all these people that are evil because they've been killing everybody and people didn't get the mark of the beast. And so they're the bad guys and they're going to die too. And then all that's going to lead up to everybody, not everybody, many, many people, I would say a large majority, being thrown in this burning lake of fire and burning forever. That's all being taught to children and adults, even from a young age. And I had people argue with me on Twitter and say, they're not teaching that to children. Bullshit. Every single Sunday morning and Sunday night, and sometimes on Wednesday night as well, I heard that story about, if you don't accept Jesus, if you died today, where would you spend eternity? And there would be an altar call every single time. So I'm 6 years old and I'm being told, if you died right now, that's a lot to lay on a six-year-old. If you died right now, where would you spend eternity? Do you know for sure you'd go to heaven or might you go to hell? Burning forever. The hottest fire that's ever existed. That's just crazy. And the further I get from it, the more I'm just like, how I believed this. I taught this. I stood in churches and told people this. But it's because you don't know anything else. It's how you were raised. Those of you that are listening that believe this right now, I get it. But sometimes you have to stop and say, wait, where's this coming from? Is this really the quote good news? Is this really the quote gospel? Burning hell, people being killed, terror, your life being broadcasted for everyone to stare and watch you. You know how my parents calmed me down that night? I was panicked. They said, everybody else is going to be worried about when their time comes up there. They're not going to be paying attention to yours. So my best case scenario is my movie was boring. Think about that. It's wild. Now, let me tell you. I'm very, very tolerant of a lot of beliefs. I think that everybody's doing their best to try to figure things out. I'm especially tolerant of Christianity because I grew up in it and I can relate to it more. But, you know, there's other religions, there's other spiritual paths, there's many ways that people are trying to understand something larger than themselves and trying to understand God in some way. There's people that have chosen a path of atheism because they just don't see any sense in the argument there's a God. And that's okay too. Because you know what? We're all just trying to figure things out, you know? But when you raise children, and this is what I'm focused on, when you raise children in this fear-based culture where they are told from the time they can even comprehend the English language or whatever language they speak, that there is a God that created them and put them on this earth, but they're so sinful and they're so evil, even from birth, because original sin, you know, that God had to send his son to be murdered, tortured, and killed because of them. And I remember being told, and this was told in a comforting way, if I had been the only person on the whole planet, Jesus would have come and died for me. And that made me feel good. It makes me feel like a shit. But this, when people believe this and they buy into it and they soak it up, this literalism and this fundamentalism, what happens is they're not even stepping back from their theology and thinking about the people that they're talking to. Because sometimes you have to step back from your theology and say, wait a minute, what am I doing here? Am I really telling a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old? And I don't care. I'm picking young kids, 8, 10, 12, 15. You pick an age, an adult. I don't care. Am I really telling them that they are so horrible that they deserve to burn in hell for all of eternity? Because that's the message. It's just nuts. The whole satanic panic fed this, but it's still with us today. And there was last year, there seemed to be a little rise in satanic panic again. I think it's kind of gone away, but the reality is the people that came out of these homes, out of this literal fear-based fundamentalist home, what has happened is many of them are just raising their children the same way because they don't know any better, because they think it's right, because they feel like this is what God wants them to do. They truly believe it. Again, I don't think they're a bunch of child abusers. I don't think they're out there saying, I want to torment my child. But you know what they're doing? They are scaring the shit out of them. They're giving them trauma. They're giving them anxiety. And there are people now who grew up during those in those churches that are now saying, oh my God, I cannot believe that I bought all this. And they're hurting. They're anxious. They're people. And they don't know what to do with that. Because if you've been raised to believe that God is the supernatural theist view of God, that he's a man sitting on the throne and he's looking down and he intervenes when he chooses to and he ignores your prayers he doesn't ignore. He says yes, no, or wait. That's what we're always told. But if you believe that, then even if you start questioning the reality of hell or questioning the reality of what you were told, he knows your inner thoughts. He's watching you. Are you sure? Are you positive that hell doesn't exist? Because if you're wrong, you're fucked. He's watching. Always. Watching you everywhere you go. We used to be told, if you go in a bar, you took Jesus in the bar with you, which I think Jesus would be fine with that, to be honest with you. this idea that you're being watched 24/7, except it's, you know, at least Santa just gives you lumps of coal. God burned you in hell forever because you didn't believe something, or you didn't do it right, or you didn't pray it right, or you didn't have enough faith. That is such a scary way to live, and so many people do. And because of this fear that's been put in them, they're afraid to buck it. They're afraid to push back. It's very, very hard for people to step away and start questioning their beliefs when their beliefs were created through irrational fears, because you're trying to rationally and logically work your way through this, but it's like telling me not to jump when you put a spotter on me. Fight or flight hits. I'm done. And so when you're telling someone, hey, step back for a minute and think about whether you really believe everything in the Bible came directly from God through someone, because that's the fundamentalist view, and that is that God practically dictated these words. They're inerrant. There's nothing in them that can ever be questioned. Is it possible instead, Paul, when he was writing his letters, Matthew, when he was writing his gospel, that they were just given the best information they had at the time? They're taking some guesses here, you know? They're trying their best. I do believe they were inspired to write those words, but being inspired is nothing compared to God dictating it to you word for word. I mean, I'm inspired to do this podcast. It doesn't mean it's from on high. It just means that something motivated me to do it. But when you ask someone, hey, step back for a minute and let's think about this. Does it make sense that a God that is full of love would create people? Oh, and he's omniscient and omnipresent. He knows everything. So he already knows when you're born if you're going to go to hell or not. And in some cases, like with a Calvinist, he dictates ahead of time. He predestines certain people for heaven, certain people for hell. And that's for his glory, because if somebody's sinful, it's God's glory that they burn forever. Now, he didn't have to create them sinful, but he did, apparently. And when you try to process through this, do you really believe, first of all, do you really believe Adam and Eve were real people? I mean, it's a great story, but I don't think that's what happened. But let's just say hypothetically they were. So there was an Adam and there was an Eve. Adam goofed up, blamed Eve, and because he did that, we're all going to hell if we don't accept Jesus. That's a huge leap. Huge leap. And so now I'm talking to people that are like, I don't believe that anymore, but I don't know what I believe because I'm afraid. Because the whole concept of religion, the whole concept of Christianity really fucked me up. It really made me anxious. It made me fearful. And I just don't think I can step foot in church again, or I don't think I can read those, you know, scriptures anymore. That's sad, because there's so many beautiful things in the Christian Bible, in the Hebrew scriptures. There's beautiful things in a lot of different writings. The Tao Te Ching, there's others. So I'm not saying the Bible is all. It's not the only sacred text in the world. There's many sacred texts. But there's beautiful stories in there about people trying to understand God, about people trying to understand the world, about people trying to understand each other and why we act the way we do. It's a real good historical capturing of what people thought about God back then. And yeah, they attributed a lot of things to God that were pretty terrible, like flooding the world and killing everyone except for one family. I doubt that happened. Now, I'm sure there was a flood. There seems to be some evidence of that. People may have died. I don't think there was some God that decided to kill people and do it that way. But when you have people start questioning that, when you start questioning, was Jesus born of a virgin? Or is it possible he was just born? He was a wonderful person, a very holy person, a person who was probably the most enlightened individual to ever walk this planet. But he might not have actually been, you know, God's son. That's a scary, scary thought to entertain when you have been raised with anxiety and guilt and fear, and questioning any of this could mean you're not really a believer. And if you're not really a believer, we're back to the rapture, you get left behind. At the end, you get thrown in hell, all these terrible things. People need relief. They need to be able to come to a spiritual place, whether it's a Buddhist temple, a Christian church, a Jewish temple, a Hindu temple, whatever. They need to be able to come there for healing, for love, for being in that moment of sacred silence. If you drive fear into people, then you're not helping them, and you're certainly not helping yourself, and you're certainly not helping the cause of your religion. Now, it may get some people in church. It may get them to drop some money in the offering plate. But what it's not doing is giving them any kind of, I don't know what word I'm looking for. It's not giving them the kind of love and affection and empathy and compassion that they deserve as human beings. Instead, what you're doing is telling people, and I'm going to say this, and this is an accurate characterization of this theology, even though it sounds gruesome. God said, either love me or I'm going to torture you for the rest of eternity. That's the bottom line. I mean, what's the difference between that and a serial killer? Except the serial killer only tortures you till you're dead, not all of eternity. People are hurting. This is dangerous. This is harmful. There's been some arguments on Twitter around children. I got involved in some of these. It's really what kind of fired this off. And it's this whole idea is, are children evil? How does this fit in here? Because we're all sinners and all this. And there are quite a few people that... And again, Calvinists, they kind of have their own track of cruelty and evil or whatever you want to call it. But there's this idea that kids are little evil beings because they're people. And because Adam sinned eons ago, these children are evil. One guy, he's real popular, I think, in the Southern Baptist Convention. He calls them vipers in diapers. And there was another person that posted. Now, later, he kind of tried to retract a little bit of it, but he was talking about his four-month-old who was crying. He was having trouble, I think, getting him to go to sleep. And he said that he had to practice discipline on him and talked about how hard it was. And he said, but he's a sinner. Now, a lot of people jumped to the conclusion he meant he spanked the kid. He later came back and said he didn't. I'm going to take his word for it. But I will tell you this. Anytime you're talking about a four-month-old and you're referring to their crying or refusing to sleep as sin, there's something wrong. There's something very, very wrong. Because a four-month-old is just learning to hold their head up. They're rolling over. I'm not sure exactly all the exact developmental stages right now, but these are babies. There's nothing evil about them. There's nothing wrong with them. In fact, Erickson's trust versus mistrust, that first psychosocial development stage, that four-month-old's in the middle of it. And with a father that sees you as a sinner, I don't know how much that's going to help him develop trust in the world, trust in people around him. Now, again, there are very good parents who think their kids are sinners. There are very good parents of all stripes, liberals, conservatives, fundamentalists. I'm not going to paint a broad picture of what's going on inside the household of every fundamentalist home. Because I can tell you, my home growing up was a pretty happy one. It was a good one. But I can tell you that some of this shit gets in you and you don't realize it until later. When my granddaughter when I first found out that she was starting to go to church, my first inclination was almost panic, because all I could think is, I hope she's not going to go to one of these churches that tells her she's an evil, bad person. That came out of me in my 50s. So that was there. And I'm like, holy shit. I guess I didn't realize myself that even though I consider myself fairly well-adjusted, and even though I have a very deep interest in spirituality, that was in me, that I feared her going to church, because I grew up and participated and was part of this fundamentalist mindset that is very damaging to children and adults, because it tells them they're bad people. They're not good enough. They're depraved. There's all kinds of words that he's for it. And that's not healthy. So what do you do with all this? I think if you've come from this kind of background, if you're listening to this right now going, that's me, you know, explore your personal beliefs. Think about, you know, I don't know what anybody's particular view of God is. I don't see God as an entity. You probably, if you've listened to my podcast, you've heard me talk about it before, that it's more of this divine presence that's in, around, and above and around us and through us, and it connects us all, and it's part of the universe, but it's bigger than the universe. I don't really get into the personalization or of God, but if you do believe that, one of the things that the Bible clearly says, it talks about being a good parent. And it says, if you know how to be a good father, how much more so your Father in heaven would be with you. It's not an exact quote, but it's really close. So if you do believe that, ask yourself, does this even make sense? Would any father kill his own child so that he doesn't have to kill his other children? I mean, the whole idea of, you know, Jesus came and died on the cross to save us from what? From God, the person that started all this? So take some time and think about which beliefs really resonate with you personally, which feel like they were imposed on you and no longer fit, and which really sits well with you. Because there's a lot of good things that I did learn about the life of Jesus, about how he taught us to treat people, about how we should take care of those that are marginalized, how we should, you know, treat others as we want to be treated, how we should look out for the poor, look out for, you know, people that need our help. Those are good things. Those resonate. Look and learn about different interpretations of scripture, and even different faiths and how they approach things. I've always thought, you know, when you see something pop up in every religion, it's kind of in that collective unconscious of humankind. And it comes through in the collective conscious of humankind. So, for example, the golden rule, treat others as you want to be treated. It's in every religion. That didn't come out of nowhere. And it predated Jesus. He didn't make that up. But I guarantee you, when he said it, it was powerful. And I guarantee you, whoever said it before him was powerful, and whoever has said it since. Because that is found everywhere. Find those common threads. If you really are traumatized, seriously, religiously traumatized, you might need to go to a therapist. It can help you unpack the effects of that fear-based upbringing. You know, they will provide a safe place to explore your feelings. Find a supportive community. Find other like-minded people. Like I said, I've had several people reach out to me privately on Twitter. I've had a couple people email me. I've had others reach out or comment in my threads saying, wow, I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember the Jack tracks. I remember seeing A Thief in the Night. It's scaring me too. Find those people. Establish relationships with healthy people who can support you on your journey of questioning and your journey of growth. I think having diverse friendships can help introduce new perspectives It can help you to feel, it's really interesting to me when I talk to someone coming from where I came from, and then I talk to someone that didn't grow up in a fundamentalist home. And sometimes I have these huge aha moments that they're like, yeah, that's how the world works. They already knew. And in a way, I'm kind of jealous. I'm like, how come you already knew this and I had to like go through all this to figure it out? But you know, we all have our journeys. We all have our ways that we're going. Personal spirituality is important. Find something that feels authentic, whether that's within a different denomination, a different religion, or a more personal non-denominational spiritual practice. Let yourself explore. Go to different religious services. Read different spiritual texts. Don't just read one, but read what people over time, over history, have discovered that have resonated with others, that they became known as masters or teachers or rabbis or, you know, whatever you want to call them, because all of these things really help to find healthy boundaries. It'll help you to establish what you believe and work within your family that may still have some of the same beliefs that you're trying to shake away. It also will help you to find that there are many ways to look at things and to know that a lot of people have a lot of questions. When you run out of questions, you're probably at the end of your life because there's always something to learn. I think other practices people have found helpful, journaling, keeping a journal of your thoughts, your doubts. You know, if I had journaled back then and then I went and read now the things that I was afraid of, I'd be like, oh my God, what was I thinking? But I'd be able to see how far I came. Writing is always helpful. Creative writing. Art, music, any of those things to help you just kind of get yourself out of this fear and anxiety. Mindfulness and meditation. I'm a huge fan of mindfulness. In fact, I was going to do a podcast on mindfulness and it got away from me and I didn't. But these things help you manage anxiety. They bring you into the present. This focus on the end times is pointless. It's, first of all, it's people guessing. Nobody really knows. And it's almost always fear-based. I mean, how often do you hear people talk about the end times and it's this wonderful end where everything comes together? It's rare. There is a group, post-millennialist in the Christian church, that do believe things are going to get better and better until like the kingdom of God comes. Post-millennialism took a huge hit, I think, after World Wars I and II, because people started saying things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. So, but generally speaking, focusing on end time drama is the kind of stuff that's going to create, again, fear and anxiety, because it's always going to this negative, bad place where we're trying to escape from all the bad things that are going to happen to us. And recognize and celebrate each step forward in your journey. Acknowledge growth and healing, no matter how small. Recovering from fear-based, literalist, fundamentalist Christian upbringing is a journey, and it involves unraveling all these deeply, deeply ingrained beliefs and fears. And again, if you don't understand that, just if you have any phobia at all—snakes, spiders, heights, whatever—think about those, and then think about how hell, the end times, whatever, is that fear for people that were raised in this kind of atmosphere. It doesn't have to be rational. You can argue with somebody all day about, hey, come on, think about it. How can, you know, why would God do this? Why would God do that? Whatever. It's irrational by definition. So fighting about it's not going to help. The best we can do is love, empathy, and compassion. It's a process of discovering your personal beliefs, your values, and identify things outside of those confines of your fundamentalist upbringing. Now, this is a challenging journey. It's not easy because you kind of feel unanchored for a while. I know when I first started really moving into panentheism and getting away from this idea that God is this entity looking down and you know, that I plead to for whatever, I felt a little unanchored for a while because I was like, oh, I'm so used to like reaching out to God when I need something. Not that he ever answered, but it was weird. But then what happened is this whole, it was liberating, and it led me to a life that's defined more by an authentic expression of who I am and my spirituality, and allows me choice and freedom. And that to me is the move towards healing. And I can say, I don't think I'm severely harmed at all by my upbringing. I think that I came through it pretty good. But I can tell you as a kid, it was not fun because I was in a wonderful, loving home, but I had this fear of God and this fear of the end times. And for a lot of people, I think that they're still experiencing that trauma. They may still even be in those atmospheres, those surroundings. And for them, it is hard. You may be listening to this and it's you and you're like, yeah, that's me. I feel that trauma. I can't face this anymore. It's when you got to let go of the worry about it, and you might just need a little time not worrying about anything that's spiritual. Clear your head, take some breaths, get away, and then come back when you're ready. It's very, very difficult to talk about this because people take it as a personal attack on themselves and on their God, who they think needs defending, and on their church. And that's personal. That's hard. People don't like that. And I get that. I don't like it when my spirituality is attacked. But these things need to be said, because every day there's a child out there somewhere being told these stories. And every day there's adults out there being told again these stories. And that's a lot to take in. It's a lot to deal with. So I'm probably going to cover this in more than one podcast because I've had people that have been sharing their stories, and I want to get a chance to share what other people have told me they've experienced as well. So stay tuned for that. But until then, I want you just to think about your own spiritual path. Is it fear-based or is it based on love? Does it cause you to want to support, love, help others, give them empathy, compassion? Or does it cause you to condemn and warn and threaten? Because one isn't healthy. The other one is. There's no time to change your mind. How could you have been so blind? The Father spoke, the demons died. The Son has come, and you've been left behind. Thank you for listening to this very personal episode. Obviously, I have a lot of feelings about it, and we'll probably be sharing some more of that in upcoming episodes. But it's good for me to talk about this as well, because I think that part of what my mission can be is if there's somebody out there that grew up the way I did, or they are currently in a place that is teaching these things, maybe I can be a voice to at least have them question and say, let me give that a second thought. I don't want to ask anybody or tell anybody what to believe or how to believe, but I do think people need to understand when they're doing things that are unhealthy and they're hurting their friends, their family, their children, themselves. And, this is just one way that I can help contribute to that. So until next time, this is Scott, and thank you so much for listening. Well, that's another episode of Observations from Life. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to check out my website at www.obsfromlife.com. You can find information on past episodes, people who have appeared on the podcast, as well as a merch store. Until next time, this is Scott. Thank you so much for listening.